been a minister of two London churches in Hackney, Baptist churches, Hackney and Bexley Heath, over the last 35 years, and I have pastored those who are same-sex attracted throughout most of my pastoral experience. Along the way, I collected a PhD in New Testament Studies at King's College London, and I'm currently an Associate Research Fellow at Spurgeon's College London. It's not my intention to go through every biblical text that has been adduced on this topic, and I will assume that you are already familiar with the main texts, nor is it my plan to give equal exegetical attention to detail to these texts. It seems to me that what is needed is a clear analysis of the reasons why the biblical writers treat human sexuality in the way they do. And as I proceed, I will offer a critique of certain assumptions and arguments used in interpreting the biblical material on homosexuality. By the term sexuality, I refer both to gender differentiation, male and female as a duality and their interrelationships, and to sexual endowment with its various biological, psychological, and social dimensions. In this paper, I will use descriptive terms that identify different approaches to the biblical material. They are not without their problems, but they have sufficient coherence and acceptance to remain useful. First, I call the classic or traditional approach because this represents the consistent understanding of the church from earliest times until the mid-20th century. The second may be termed the revisionist approach. This represents the attempt to re-envisage what the text might be saying from the perspective of the experiences of gays and lesbians, both within and without the church, in the light of modern research into ancient attitudes to sexuality. I need to put my cards on the table at the start and to say that I have yet to be persuaded by the revisionist arguments that I have seen. My aim, however, is to be fair in presenting viewpoints that differ from mine own and to listen intently to all viewpoints expressed in this symposium in the hope of learning from all. In my library, I have a 1757 second edition of Wesley's Notes on the New Testament. Inside this volume, I found a slip of paper with a handwritten note as follows. Quote, all scripture connects itself with Genesis and ought to be read in this connection, for it is not so much that it is the later scriptures that throw light on Genesis, as it is Genesis that throws light on the later scripture, end quote. This is a canonical assessment with which I am in overall agreement. In particular, Genesis chapter 1 to chapter 2 verse 3 not only functions as an introduction to Genesis itself, but it also introduces the whole of the Bible. Its canonical placing is both emphatic and essential, for it asserts, among other things, the fundamental goodness of the creation as ordered by God. This arrangement results in two parallel accounts of creation, which fulfill slightly different purposes, but which taken together form the framework that governs the biblical understanding of human sexuality. Now, we should note at this juncture that the Hebrew language has no general terms for sexuality as such. But this does not mean that the Hebrew mind did not have a deep understanding and insight into the varied expressions of what we call sexuality, both negative and positive. Pride of place in the biblical canon must go to the Song of Songs, which embodies a rich understanding of human sexuality, although not one cast in modern psychosexual terms. In the light of this, the assertion that a concept of homosexuality was not available to the biblical writers is potentially misleading. It just so happens that the Hebrew language has no word expressing the general concept of idolatry. But it does have a rich and varied vocabulary for dealing with the social realia and describing the pagan mindset of those who worshipped other gods. In fact, the foundation for biblical critiques of idolatry is to be found in both the explicit creational monotheism and the implicit critique of the worship of that which is merely creaturely that is contained in Genesis 1. And the relevance of this point will become evident in Paul's treatment of idolatry and sexual immorality in Romans 1. We begin with the opening chapters of Genesis. The most thorough examination of all the texts that have anything whatsoever to do with the topic of sexuality in the Old Testament is to be found in Richard Davidson's 844-page book entitled Flame of Yahweh, Sexuality in the Old Testament, published in 2007. Davidson seems to have read virtually everything relevant up to this date, as can be gathered from the 142-page bibliography. Someone has to do it. I'm glad it's not me. He is particularly good on Genesis 1-3 and the Song of Songs, which he interprets as a return to Eden. And it is all the more pity that I've yet to find any engagement with this work in the recent literature. Davidson states the conclusions of his research at the start. He argues that the, quote, Edenic pattern for sexuality constitutes the foundation for the rest of the Old Testament perspective on this topic. The consequence is that, quote, the final canonical form of the Hebrew Bible presents a unified, consistent, overarching theological portrait of human sexuality, end quote. Davidson draws attention to the fact that the nature and theology of sexuality receive central and climactic placement within both creation accounts. Only after the creation of humankind, singled out as made in the image of God and as male and female, only then is the whole created order declared to be very good, Genesis 1:31. Gender is therefore not merely a sociological construct, but has theological grounding in God's good creation. Furthermore, as far as the topic of creation is concerned, it is only the creation of humankind as male and female that is dealt with in Genesis chapter 2. And this chapter culminates in verse 24 with, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. Genesis 2 thus fills out the content of Genesis 1, 26 to 28 in two important respects. First, Genesis 2 makes clear that only as husband and wife are the man and the woman to fulfill their mandate to be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. And second, Genesis 2 makes clear that the creation of humankind does not involve any aspect of divine procreation. The differentiation of male and female is presented as a creation of God from the material order and not as an inherent part of the divine nature itself. Other creation myths divinized sex, but Genesis will have nothing to do with that understanding of the divine role in creating human beings. I find, therefore, that Karl Barth's explanation of the Imago Dei, primarily in terms of the relationality of male and female, misses the mark, valuable though his contribution is. Rather, the image of God primarily refers to the representational nature of the man and woman as rulers and stewards over creation as God's vice regents. Both Adam and Eve are complete in their own right as God's image bearers, but the complementarity of male and female is necessary for the reproduction of other image bearers who will fill the earth and thus provides the divine paradigm for humanity from the very beginning. The Hebrew al-ken, therefore, or for this reason, at the beginning of Genesis 2:24, indicates that male and female is to be the pattern of all future human sexual relationships. In other words, humanity is binary in gender, and it is this complementary reality that forms the basis of marriage. This complementary reality at least includes biological differentiation, which would be evident in their primal nudity, with the congruence of their outwardly differing sexual organs being necessary for their reproductive purposes. Marriage is thus described in terms of a one flesh union, which also points back to the taking of the woman from the man. James Brownson attempts to subvert this understanding of Genesis 2 in his book Bible, Gender, Sexuality, Reframing the Church's Debate on Same-Sex Relationships, published last year. His argument that as scholars do not agree exactly what the nature of this complementarity is, that it is therefore not a useful concept, is a weak one. Brownson further argues that the emphasis in Genesis 2 is on similarity rather than difference. And this is brought out by the rejection of the animals as suitable candidates to fulfill the role of helper to Adam. and by Adam's recognition of Eve as bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. However, the Genesis texts emphasize both similarity and difference, and it is difference which is emphasized on the surface of the text. In Genesis 1:27, humanity, Ha'adam, is described as both male, Zakar, and female, Nekeva, for the purpose of reproduction. In Genesis 2:23, humanity, Ha'adam, formed from the dust, Adama, is differentiated as man, Ish, and woman, Isha, for the purpose of marriage. It is the difference that is important for the purpose of the text. Indeed, in Genesis 2:18, the Hebrew konegdo, suitable for him, bears the sense of equal but opposite. If similarity were meant, then the more natural phrase would be kamoho, like him. Thus, the animals are not suitable partners for Ha'adam because they are not his equal. However, the woman is a suitable partner for him because she is both his equal and his opposite. Now, Brownson attempts to show that Genesis 2:23-24 is merely a pattern for kinship relations, as there is no mention of the role of procreation in Genesis 2. And the phraseology, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, is used of other kinship relationships in the Bible. He argues that procreation does not exhaust the meaning and purpose of one flesh union, a view which the Bible endorses in the extolling of sexual intimacy and bonding as a good in its own right. There is, after all, no mention of procreation or even the womb in the Song of Songs, and Paul never introduces the topic of procreation in his discussions on marriage. And so Brownson argues that Genesis does not view procreation to be of the essence of marriage. The emphasis rather is on meeting Adam's need in his aloneness, chapter 2, verse 18, and on the unitive purpose of marriage, 2:24. If the essence of marriage and its primary purpose is to be seen as unitive, then committed and faithful gay sexual unions may be seen as legitimate expressions of kinship unions as defined by Genesis 2:24. However, if this were the crux of the matter, then this need would be equally well met by producing another male to be his helper, something which both the text and context are at pains to deny. To achieve his ends, Brownson has to play down the fact of the mention of father and mother in Genesis 2:24, containing within it an explicit endorsement of the heterosexual pattern for marriage, as well as an implicit critique of incest, and with that to minimise the connection with male and female in Genesis 1:27. In fact, the main plank in Brownson's overall exegetical strategy is isolating and minimising the overarching influence of Genesis 1 on texts dealing with marriage and with homosexuality. We see this particularly in his treatment of Jesus' discussion on divorce and marriage in Mark chapter 10, verses 6 to 8, where Jesus quotes from both Genesis 1:27 and 2:24. It is instructive to note that Brownson makes no reference to Jesus' quotation of Genesis 1:27 when dealing with this passage. He thus succeeds in putting asunder what Jesus has joined together. Indeed, if the unitive purpose of marriage is what counts, then one is left wondering why Jesus didn't quote Genesis 2:18. It's not good for a man to be alone, instead of 1:27. Furthermore, when he does discuss the language of one flesh with reference to male-female unions, he asserts that although the Bible normally speaks in this way, quote, the Bible does not inherently and of itself indicate that it views such linkages normatively, end quote. Richard Davidson, for one, would be very surprised by that conclusion. There are several false moves and consequent problems underlying this approach to Jesus' treatment of sexuality here. Firstly, there is the assumption, which I've already alluded to, that Jesus' positive statement of marriage as being heterosexual in nature, a position which every Jew known to us from the Hellenistic era also held, is only to be understood descriptively and not prescriptively. This is mere assertion. All the evidence we have is against it, unless we wish to appeal to Gnostic texts. Others assert that Jesus implicitly approved of homosexual relationships in some circumstances, and instance the centurion and his servant whom Jesus healed. Here the assumption is that all master-slave relationships involved a sexual dimension, a not uncommon occurrence in the Greco-Roman world, and thus Jesus was knowingly restoring the loved one to the lover. Or perhaps Jesus even had a homosexual relationship with a beloved disciple. Or Lazarus, who is described as the one you love, is ill in John chapter 11, verse 3. These rank as examples of sexegesis of the highest order. All other attempts like this suffer from very high degrees of historical implausibility. And I refer you to Robert Gagnon's book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice, Texts and Hermeneutics, published in 2001, for a more detailed refutation of these and similar proposals. Secondly, the question needs to be put that if Jesus wanted to extend the biblical understanding of marriage to include same-sex marriage, then why did he not make the most of the opportunity to do so? Jesus subverted the traditional family by placing allegiance to himself above that of parents, spouses, family and children, Matthew 19, verse 29. He redefined kinship obligations when he asked, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" answering his own question, "Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother," Mark 3, 33 to 35. Jesus could hardly have caused more of a stir among his contemporaries by redefining marriage than he did by challenging widespread and deeply held understandings of the temple, the Sabbath, purity laws, and the Samaritan question, among others. These issues functioned to define and strengthen Jewish identity, but Jesus had no qualms about taking a very different line to that of the religious authorities on these important matters. Thirdly, this approach that Brownson takes and others do proceeds via the argument from silence. Jesus is said never to have said anything about homosexuality, and so we cannot know what he thought about it. The argument from silence, of course, can prove nothing, for he never said anything directly about polygamy or incest, or for that matter, about idolatry and cultic worship. We can, however, strongly infer his attitude to idolatry both from what he says about serving God or mammon, Matthew 6:24, and the fact that he was a Jew. Similarly, we can be certain beyond reasonable doubt what view he would have taken on homosexuality. Jesus' positive endorsement of a yes to heterosexual marriage brings with it a no to all other forms of sexual relationship. We know of no Jew from the Hellenistic era who thought differently on this matter. In fact, Jesus does refer to sexual immorality alongside adultery in Mark chapter 7 and verse 21. It is historically inconceivable that any Jew, including Jesus, would think of sexual immorality other than in terms of the prohibitions found in Leviticus 18, which includes a specific prohibition on homosexual practice. This was understood and accepted in every Jewish text that we have from the Hellenistic era on this topic. Furthermore, where Jesus introduces new teaching on sexuality, it is by way of tightening the standards of sexual conduct and extending the definition of sexual sin to the realm of thought and imagination. Finally, I might point out a troubling consequence of relegating Jesus' endorsement of the Genesis text to the level of normality only. If the male-female variable in the marriage equation is not fixed, then on what basis can it be argued that the numeric variable must remain fixed? Polyamorists would argue that faithful, committed, and loving relationships within a group of adults of whatever combination of sex and orientation are really only at one end of the distribution curve of normality. Such group relationships would also qualify for consideration as marriage, precisely because faithfulness, commitment, and love can be predicated of groups as well as of pairs. We move now to the consideration of the only text in the Bible that provides a theologically based discussion of homosexuality. Paul's argument in Romans 1, 18 to 32 has become a battleground in recent decades. Revisionist interpretations bring various arguments to demonstrate that Paul is not referring to lifelong committed same-sex unions, which seem miraculously to have emerged only in modern times. I will proceed by analysing some of these arguments before taking a detailed look at Romans 1. The first issue to be addressed relates to the state and extent of knowledge about homosexuality in New Testament times. Would Paul or anyone else in the Roman Empire have known that lifelong committed homosexual relationships were possible, or that homosexuality might have been regarded as a lifelong condition? Well, we find just such issues being discussed in Plato's Symposium from the 4th century BCE. After Plato's Republic, the Symposium was the most widely known and discussed text of the Academy. This should not surprise us, as its topic is that of eros, or love. Tom Wright notes that, quote, the influence of Plato himself remained massive throughout the New Testament period, end quote. For example, Horace, Ovid, and Cicero all went to Athens to complete their education. Furthermore, the Academy had several branches throughout the Mediterranean, including a famous one at Tarsus, Paul's home city. Strabo even tells us that the philosophical schools in Tarsus were in better shape than those of Athens and Alexandria. And thanks to the work of the late German New Testament scholar Martin Hengel, we are now fully aware that Jewish culture within Palestine, as well as the diaspora, was thoroughly Hellenized well before the time of Jesus. It is almost inconceivable, therefore, that as educated a man as Paul was not fully conversant with what Greeks and Romans thought about homosexuality, and that Jews in general were not aware of this to one degree or another. It is in the Symposium that we find the first extant reference to female homoeroticism. Aristophanes speaks there of heteristriae, women who are sexually attracted to women, and explains this phenomenon and that of male homoeroticism in terms of having their origin in primeval beings consisting of two halves with two sets of the same genitalia. Heterosexuals originally had two different sets of genitalia, and these beings were divided in two by Zeus as a punishment, and each half of the pair in this world is engaged in a search for their lost other half so that they may be reunited again. This account clearly presupposes an understanding of sexuality as present at birth, and that the goal is one of lifelong union with one's lost primeval partner. Bernadette Bruton, in her book Love Between Women, Early Christian Responses to Female Homoeroticism, published in 1996, adduces further evidence for lifelong erotic orientation in the Hellenistic literature of the period. For example, there are astrological texts which understand that the position of the stars and planets at birth predetermine erotic orientation. Also, some medical texts seek to explain erotic orientation in terms of the processes of conception. Furthermore, the Symposium discusses the desirability of lifelong homoerotic unions. Pausanias refers to the pederast who takes a sexual interest in young men who reach the stage of growing beards, which he regards as coincident with gaining intelligence. He says, quote, those who begin to love them at this point, I think, are prepared to be with them through the whole of life and pass their lives in common, rather than deceiving them by catching them in the thoughtlessness of youth and then contemptuously abandoning them and running off with someone else. End quote. And a little later, Pausanias speaks of, quote, the lover of a worthy character that abides through life, for he is joined to that, to what is constant. Bruton also adduces 2nd century CE evidence for women, woman-to-woman marriages. In the light of these texts, it will no longer do to assert that Paul could not have had knowledge of lifelong same-sex orientation and union. The second issue to be dealt with is the argument that Paul casts his discussion of homosexuality in terms that betray specific cultural understandings of gender, the passions, purity and impurity, honour and shame, and nature. Of course, Paul was not alone in expressing disapproval of homosexuality. In Plato's last work, The Laws, he speaks of the same-sex relations as contrary to nature and a daring or shameless act exhibiting a lack of self-control. I will mention five aspects of cultural accommodation that are adduced in the literature to help understand Paul's thought. First, male homoeroticism in the Greco-Roman world was generally disapproved of because it required the passive partner to act like a woman in being penetrated. Officially, Roman law deemed same-sex intercourse between citizens as stuprum, a criminal act, because the high status of citizenship was violated in the case of the passive partner. No such status violation occurs when the passive partner is socially inferior, such as a non-citizen or a slave. Honour, in this situation, is maintained by the higher status individual as long as he was the active partner. Thus, the feminization of men was regarded as shameful in a culturally specific gendered way. It is argued that in a culture where gender is no longer defined sexually in terms of activity, which equates to masculinity, and passivity, which equates to femininity, then Paul's strictures do not make sense. Second, another cultural presupposition concerning homosexuality was that it was the result of an excess of passion and therefore was always an expression of lust. Where such assumptions no longer pertain, then it is argued that Paul's critique is no longer relevant and that he would not condemn gay relationships that are faithful, loving, and committed. Third, it is often asserted that Paul is speaking against coercive homosexual practice, such as pederasty, or forced sex between master and slave, where the power relations are unequal. Against this restriction, it might be noted that Paul begins Romans 1:27 with "in the same way" or "likewise," homoios, with reference to lesbianism in the previous verse. And there is no evidence for the female equivalent of such coercive relationships in the many discussions on homosexuality in the classical world. Furthermore, common and specific vocabulary describing these types of homosexual relationship is also lacking in Romans. Fourth, it is said that Paul's concern relates to cultic impurity. However, the language of purity and impurity relates as much to marriage in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 7 and the discussion there, and Hebrews 13 verse 4, where the concern is for holiness within the church as a temple of the Holy Spirit without any particular reference to pagan idolatry. And fifth, another interpretive approach focuses on the link between idolatry and homosexuality. Of course, the link between idolatry and all forms of sexual immorality was a commonplace in Jewish thought. The link is even implicit within the Genesis 1 account, in that the schema of creation over 6 days can be read as a polemic against anything in the created order being regarded as worthy of worship. All cultures known to the Jews worship gods together with their representational images in various material forms, or they worship the heavenly bodies themselves as gods. And the Jewish polemic against the use of idols uses the creator-creature dichotomy as its basic rationale. The association of idolatry with sexual immorality was most fully expressed, of course, in the fertility cults, but it was not necessarily confined to them. However, it would be absurd to think that the Hebrew mindset condemned sexual immorality only when it occurred within temple precincts or as a part of religious ritual. The Creator God of Genesis 1 is sovereign over all creation and all human activity, and all aspects of human life are accountable to him. Within the Jewish community, which had experienced redemption by God from slavery, this accountability found expression in the Torah, literally instruction. in the form of laws that governed cultic, family, personal, and civic life, which includes laws prohibiting homosexual practice. The argument that Leviticus 18:22 or 20:13 are to be interpreted as applying only to homosexual practice within the context of idolatry, based on references to the child sacrificing cult of Molech in Leviticus 18:21 and 20:2-5, is merely an attempt to establish guilt by loose association. I'm not aware of any evidence for homosexual practices being connected with the Molech cult. Significantly, the term Kadesh, meaning male shrine prostitute, used in Deuteronomy 23 verses 17 to 18, is absent in Leviticus. Furthermore, if we are to understand the limitation of the prescription of homosexuality to cultic context only, are then the associated laws in Leviticus 18 and 20 to do with incest, adultery, the use of mediums, etc., similarly constrained by that cultic context? The rationale for the inclusion and specification of the cult of Molech within the Levitical code is to be found elsewhere, probably in the protection of children within the ordering of family life, or perhaps in the fact that it too was regarded as an extremely detestable practice. What are we to make of these 5 points? The larger part of James Brownson's book is given over to a 4-chapter analysis of Paul's teaching on sexuality in Romans 1 around these issues, under the headings of lust and desire, purity and impurity, honour and shame, and nature. It is not to be denied that Paul draws on the language of all these categories in his exposition. Brownson seeks to argue that it is these culturally defined categories that shape Paul's argument and therefore define what Paul is really tilting at. However, he achieves this by minimising the influence of Genesis 1 in Paul's thought and exposition here. Let's have a look at how Paul presents his material in Romans 1. The specific background of Genesis 1 to Paul's argument is evident within the text. There is a direct reference to the creation of the world, verse 20. There is a direct reference to the Creator, verse 25. Paul denotes the sexes as females, thelei, and males, arsenes, following the Septuagint of Genesis 1:27, arsen kai thelu. Paul takes up the same terms, likeness, image, and man in 1:23 from Genesis 1:26. And Paul refers to birds, animals, and reptiles in 1:23, which also occur in Genesis 1:26. And in this tripartite form, agrees with the tripart formulation in Genesis 1:30. These points demonstrate that the load-bearing structure of Paul's argument is his vigorous creational monotheism. Now, Paul is well able to dress that structure with ideas drawn from Gentile culture that cohere with his essentially Jewish worldview and serve his purpose. But it is a mistake to think that the course of his argument is in any way determined by such concerns. Tom Wright puts it like this: Paul's understanding of ethics, rooted in Jewish creational monotheism, was that of a genuinely human existence in which the new creation was coming to birth. He affirmed the goodness of the original creation, hence the strong emphasis on classic Jewish sexual ethics, the key point where Paul insisted that Gentile converts should renounce Gentile ways. Therefore, when Paul speaks about nature, phusis, in the context of Romans 1, he can only be referring to the order of creation, and not specifically human nature, or more generally, social convention. Paul draws on the stock-in-trade themes of idolatry and sexuality from his understanding of Genesis 1 and the Old Testament in his exposition of how and why the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of human beings who suppress the truth by their wickedness. The way in which Paul relates his treatment of idolatry and homosexuality is presented in revisionist interpretations as if homosexuality is a subset of the main theme of idolatry, and therefore to be interpreted wholly within that cultic context. This is a fundamental misunderstanding of Paul's theological logic. There is no direct relationship between the incidence of idolatry and the incidence of homosexuality in his reasoning. Both Paul's treatment of idolatry and his treatment of homosexuality are given as separate and parallel examples of the direct consequence of human failure to worship God as the Creator, namely, to glorify God as God and to give thanks to Him. As a result, people's thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened, verse 21. This theme is picked up again in verse 28, where human desire to reject the knowledge of the one Creator God results in depraved thoughts and conduct, as listed in verses 29 to 31. William Loder notes that, quote, Paul's primary argument is that what led to wrong sex was wrong theology, end quote. Thus, Paul is not arguing that same-sex activity is wrong when associated with idolatry. Rather, he is demonstrating that the world is idolatrous by highlighting same-sex activity. And so why does Paul single out homosexual conduct in verses 26 and 27? Interestingly, Paul gives no other specific examples of sexual immorality in Romans, and this is a further clue as to Paul's theological logic. In what follows, I am indebted to Simon Gathercole, who is senior lecturer in New Testament at the University of Cambridge and an elder at Eden Baptist Church, Cambridge. According to Paul, the suppression of the knowledge of God available through his creative activity, verses 19 to 20, involves not only a rejection, but also an exchange. The leitmotif of exchange is found three times in verses 23, 25, and 26. Specifically, the exchange that is highlighted is that of swapping the glory of the immortal God and the truth about God for false and worthless idols, verses 22 to 23 and 25. This rejection stroke exchange motif functions as a kind of meta-sin in Romans 1, which produces sins of bodily degradation in general, verse 24, female and male homosexuality, verses 26 to 27, and in doing what ought not to be done, literally doing what is not fitting, verse 28. This is expanded into the list of sins in verses 29 to 31. The end result of all such behaviour, according to God's decree, is death, verse 32. Another leitmotif in this passage is the theme of God's handing people over to their sins, verses 24, 26, and 28. Paul's key argument here functions to show that God hands sinners over into situations which precisely highlight the meta-sin of the rejection-exchange motif in relation to idolatry. And there's also an irony to be found here in that what humans desire is the exact opposite of what it should be. Taking verses 22 to 24 first, in place of the reality of glory, they get literally a likeness of an image, a form of double insubstantiality. In place of the immortal one, they choose mortal objects of worship. In place of God, the Creator, they serve people, birds, animals, and snakes, other created things. As a result of these human decisions, God repays these deeds in a measure-for-measure fashion. In 1:24, they are said first to be handed over to uncleanness, which is an apt description of the impurity of idolatry, a fact compounded by the mention of serpents, which themselves are unclean. And second, their abandonment of God's glory or honour results in the dishonouring of their bodies. They are made in the image of God. Something similar is going on in verse 28, where there is a play on the words "uk edokimasan" and "eis adikimon noon," which is difficult to bring out in translation. Gathercole paraphrases, "God punishes the action of not considering him worthy with a mind that cannot consider whether something is worthy or not." We now turn to the controversial reference to homosexuality in verses 26 and 27. It's worth pausing to note that this is the only specific reference to lesbianism in the Bible. Here, the ironic correspondence between idolatry and homosexual practice goes deeper than the verbal parallel between exchanging the truth of God for a lie, verse 25, and the subsequent exchange of natural for unnatural practice, verse 26. Rather, Gathercole argues that, quote, the key correspondence lies in the fact that both involve turning away from the other to the same. But simply, Paul's analysis of the human predicament is predicated on the fact that the human creature ends up worshipping other similarly creaturely things rather than the Creator, who is the other, with a capital O. This is against the natural order of things and represents, in Martin Luther's phrase, an incurvatus in se, a turning in on oneself. Humanity should be oriented toward God, the other, but instead turns in on itself as a part of creation. The woman in her sexuality should be orientated towards her other, the man, but turns in on one who is the same, verse 26. The man in his sexuality should be oriented towards his other, the woman, but turns in on one who is the same, verse 27. Construing Paul's reasoning in this way makes excellent sense of his linking idolatry with homosexuality. This particular connection also perfectly illustrates the measure-for-measure punishment in that the incurvatus in se of worship, verse 25, results in the incurvatus in se of sex, a rejection of the other in preference for the same. Thus they receive in themselves the due penalty for their error, verse 27, which also links us back to the truth-error duality to Paul's theological understanding of idolatry. Paul is therefore not focusing on particular cultic practices which would contextualise his strictures to the priests of the goddess cults who violated gender roles by castration, cross-dressing and effeminization and all their works. Neither does he have male temple prostitution specifically in his sights. Paul does not make use of any of the many terms available to him, which would clearly indicate that he is specifying cultic homosexual practices. Homosexual conduct would not be acceptable to Paul in any form, not even in non-idolatrous religious societies such as to be found in Jewish communities in Jerusalem or Judea, because for him and for all Jews, it is the order of creation in Genesis that reveals God's will. We might stop to ask why Paul mentions lesbianism first. There was much discussion of pederasty and master-slave homosexual relations in the classical world, but there is little discussion of lesbianism in comparison, and it is almost entirely cast in negative terms. Perhaps Paul is leading with his strongest suit, knowing that he can assume near universal pagan agreement on the unnaturalness of female homoeroticism. Some scholars have attempted to problematize the reference to lesbianism by noting that the phrase exchange natural sexual relations for unnatural ones, this can also describe heterosexual non-vaginal sexual activity, apparently with the purpose of avoiding pregnancy. And indeed, the earliest quotations we have of Romans 1:26 are applied heterosexually in this fashion. It is not to be doubted that this type of activity is also covered by the use of this phrase. The issue here in these texts is simply one of what is the topic under discussion. And in this case, teachers in the early church seeking a text to justify a prohibition against non-vaginal marital sex turned to Romans 1:26. However, it makes no sense whatsoever for Paul to choose this as his first vice following the topic of idolatry, as this would be unique in the standard idolatry and sexual immorality topos with which he is working, besides the fact that Paul shows no interest in procreation in his discussions on marriage. And of course, the Homoios in 127 speaks against it. Finally, with reference to 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:10, the terms malakoi and arsenokoites describe the passive and active sexual roles in homosexual practice, translating the first term as prostitute, as it is in a number of translations, is incorrect. We have come a long way, and I will now finish with a couple of quotations. The first from Bill Loder of Perth, Australia, who spent a five-year full-time professorial fellowship from 2005 to 2010 researching every Jewish text from the Hellenistic era which touched on the topic of sexuality. In this, he has done an incalculable service. And the fruit of this research has been published in five book-length monographs, not all of which I have read. The last monograph, however, is on the New Testament material. There is no one who knows more about this area of ancient attitudes to sexuality in Jewish Hellenistic texts than Bill Loder. Now, after his discussion on Paul in Romans 1, in which he shows that the classic interpretation of this passage is indeed almost certainly correct, he says this: "My concern in seeking to elucidate as clearly as possible what Paul was saying comes not from a belief in Paul's abiding authority, nor a desire to depict his views as resembling or matching my own. My hermeneutical perspective is to bring to his writing the respect it warrants as one of the earliest documents of the Christian movement, a respect I believe is due, at the very least, to all human beings." Now, I wish that I could say that the biblical material has been treated with such respect by others. It's a very high standard that Bill Loder sets. Now, the second quote is from the Roman Catholic American scholar Luke Timothy Johnson, whose New Testament introduction, The Writings of the New Testament, is an important set text. He also wishes to argue in favour of same-sex unions. And as you will have gathered, this I cannot do. But I sympathise with him when he says, "The task demands intellectual honesty. I have little patience with efforts to make scripture say something other than what it says, through appeals to linguistic or cultural subtleties. The exegetical situation is straightforward. We know what the text says." The million-dollar question is, as Luke Timothy Johnson goes on to say, what do we do with what the text says? And his answer is, quote, "to reject the straightforward commands of Scripture and appeal instead to another authority." And so the debate continues unabated.